I have four commitments to announce. I'll do it quickly so we can get on with the program. But let me say I want to thank especially the people who are going to be here. This is our last big special session on overcoming poverty in challenging environments. And I want to thank the participants, but you have here the Secretary General of ASEAN, the President of Haiti, the President of Sierra Leone, who was elected in a stunning democratic process after a horrible, long conflict in his country. And I know Ed Tony Blair, who had something to do with that. I know that he's very proud of that. But and Helene Gayle, the President of CARE, this is a great, great panel. And I'm sure they will say what you heard in the last panel, which is that poor people in poor countries, well-governed, are good investments. So I thank them for being here. Now, let me just make the announcements quickly of the commitments. First, I want to invite to the stage Kathy Bushkin-Calvin, the Executive Vice President of the UN Foundation, Antonio Guterres, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Catherine Kamal, a seven-year-old young lady who is a fundraiser for bed nets, bless her heart. Hello. And the Commissioner of the National Basketball Association, David Stern. Since we also have had Dikembe Mutombo here, you can tell who's the commissioner and who's the player. Okay, here's their commitment. The UN Foundation, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the National Basketball Association, the Women's National Basketball Association, and the Union for Reform Judaism have committed to engage a global audience of 25 million through their Nothing But Nets program. So all of you basketball fans know that has now a double meaning, to work with their partners to deliver bed nets to a newly targeted refugee population. The commitment is worth $2 million over 4 years to provide 2 million refugees with long-lasting, insecticide-treated bed nets to help reduce the number of malaria cases and malaria mortality and morbidity. Nothing But Nets expands the previous UN Foundation initiatives that have already touched 25 million people by focusing these particular efforts on refugee populations who otherwise would not benefit from the global health initiatives that require the governments to request the funding. These people have basically fallen through the cracks, and we're going to close them. Even though the recent preventive initiatives are staggering and the number of people contracting malaria every year has been revised downward by something more than 10%, it's still a huge, huge number. And keep in mind, more than 25% of the deaths are children under five. So that's why the participation of this young lady is so important and so commendable. So let's give them all a big hand. Next, I'd like to invite Pamela Passman, the Corporate Vice President, Deputy General Counsel of Microsoft, and Jerry Elliott, Corporate Vice President, Worldwide Public Sector at Microsoft, to come up. Hello.
Thanks again.
This is a commitment to expand the reach of the Microsoft Partners in Learning program for innovative teachers. In 75 countries during the next 5 years, Microsoft will expand their efforts in teachers' programs to 25 more countries, more than 100 countries allowing teachers to work together. Over 10 million teachers will be trained by 2013 with the necessary skills to use technology in their classrooms as part of the Partners in Learning programs. and they will touch the lives in turn of more than 100 million students worldwide. Studies have shown a direct correlation, between the extent to which teachers can contact each other and work together and the extent to which their students' learning improves. One study showed that 8th grade students whose teachers received professional development on computers gained in math scores of up to 13 weeks above their grade level. This is a big deal in developing countries because while most of us who obsess about the Millennium Development Goals talk about the numbers of students who never go to school, and that is a very big problem, there are 100 million more who go to school but lack basic learning materials, trained teachers, and any opportunity for professional development. So I'm very grateful, and this is a $50 million commitment from Microsoft. I thank them very, very much. I would now like to invite to the stage, to make sure I haven't messed this up, just a minute, Andy Cooper, the founder and president of LeapFrog Investment, and Dr. Jim Roth, who is a partner in LeapFrog. A game I once played as a child. Thank you. LeapFrog Investment is partnering with Ashoka, Quindia Micro Insurance Center, Akin Gump, Wally Ryan, Attridge Sterling Wolanecki, and consultants from around the world to launch the world's largest micro insurance initiative. This will enable 25 million low-income people to access affordable quality insurance and financial services. 15 million of them will be women and children. The program will begin in India, Pakistan, South Africa, Ghana, and Kenya. The estimated market size for microinsurance is 1 billion people. Less than 3% of these people now have any kind of insurance. This commitment over the next decade is worth $100 million, and we thank them. Now I'd like to ask Aishin Oziyajan, the founder of Mother Child Education Foundation, and Ayla Goksail, the CEO of the Mother Child Education Foundation, to come up here and be recognized for the commitment they have made with Turkish Ministry of Education, Social Services and Child Protection Agency, and the Hansu Oziyajan Foundation and FIBA Holding. Their commitment is to close the gap in early childhood education and create women's empowerment initiatives in Turkey. The commitment will develop and provide quality early education, parenting, and female literacy programs throughout Turkey. It's very interesting that they're doing this, by the way, because I have been approached just in the last week leading up to CGI from advocates of early childhood education reprimanding me for not doing enough in developing areas for low-income people in early childhood education, since we now know that so much of the brain's infrastructure is developed in the first 3 years of life. So they're coming here at a great time. 80,000 mothers, 80,000 children, 26,000 illiterate women, 14,000 fathers will directly benefit from these programs, more than 200,000 others indirectly. Studies show there's more than a 10% difference in male and female literacy rates in Turkey. Only 32% of preschool-age children have access to preschool education there, and they are committing efforts worth $24 million to close this gap. It's a great commitment. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you. And we'll start this panel. We have an incredible panel of leaders in a variety of different regions in the world. And as President Clinton said, this panel is really to focus on some of the countries that are facing really complex obstacles, but look at how can development nonetheless take place, and what are some of the challenges, what are some of the obstacles, but also what are some of the opportunities. You know, I know like most of you in this audience, we come to CGI because it's a real jolt of optimism once a year that we all need, an infusion of people who are gathered because they believe that there is something that can be done with these intractable problems, and really come here for action. But I think we also need to think about what are some of the obstacles when we leave here that people face and countries face. And so we're going to talk across the spectrum about some of these issues. Maybe I'll just start with a question to President Karuma. And President Clinton already made the introductions, and so I'm not going to go through all the introductions over again. But you recently took office, 2007, in a very open, free, fair election. It was something that I think the world really heralded. You came from a business background, and so you recognize the importance of the business sector and economic growth. We know that you also came out of a history of about a decade-long conflict. Economic growth is both a cause as well as a consequence of conflict. I know this is a big issue for you, and how you can really look at the economic growth of a country that's just coming out of this decade-long conflict. You said you're going to run your country like a business. Tell us a little bit about that, and what are your what's your vision for economic growth and stability in your country?
Thank you very much. Let me thank the Clinton Global Initiative for having me here. I bring all of you greetings from Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone was in the news over the years for the bad reasons, but I am pleased to say that Sierra Leone has come round. We have been through a democratic election and a democratic transition of government that I believe is a standing and shining example in Africa that has made Sierra Leoneans proud once more. But beyond the elections, we have inherited as a government a country that has been devastated over the period. The little infrastructure that was there was gone. We have mortality rates that are very, very high, especially for the child and the child-bearing mothers. The illiteracy is very, very high. Unemployment opportunities are not readily available. But in the midst of all this, there are huge opportunities. Opportunities of a country that have abundance of resources, opportunities that of a country that have a huge potential of agricultural productivity, and opportunities of a country with the right investment can be one of the best tourist destinations in the world. Now, our challenge is to put a machinery that will restore the confidence and hope of the people, a machinery that will restore economic growth once more, and a machinery that will restore the support and confidence of the international community. So, I mean, you can see that there is a great challenge out there, a great work to be done with limited resources. Now, we have to do things quickly. As a government, we believe that we must, in the first place, try to consolidate the peace and show that the tragic past that Sierra Leoneans had is put behind them permanently. And that is why our steps towards consolidating the peace is to ensure that everybody should be involved in the issue of governance. We have to improve on the governance mechanism of the country, transparency and accountability. That is why we have moved quickly in ensuring that we have put in place the laws and anti-corruption laws that are about the strongest in Africa. We have ensured that the issues that go along with unemployment, the drugs and other things, we have addressed as quickly as possible to get the confidence of the people restored and everybody on track. We have tried to have an inclusive government wherein everybody is involved. And we have to a great extent tried to meet some of the benchmarks that are expected of a government that will attract the international community again. I am pleased to say that the World Bank is back, the IMF is back, the EU is giving us support. The DFID, which is the greatest supporting agency to us, is also back. We are enjoying all of that. But in the midst of all of this, we still have a situation in which unemployment is very high. We need to ensure that we restore the infrastructure that will keep the economy functioning again. And that is why, as a government, we identified three areas of priorities. We took the challenge of restoring energy. We believe with energy, a lot of what should happen in turning around the economy, in increasing the social delivery services, will happen. We believe that with energy, we will be able to cut down the cost of doing business. That will attract investors, and we have done that. We are in the process of building up that aspect. And to address the issue of employment, we have zeroed in on agricultural productivity. Agriculture, because 70% of our people are involved in the agricultural sector, but because of the subsistence nature of the agricultural sector, most of them represent the 60% of the population that is living below the poverty line. We believe by addressing the agricultural sector, enhancing its productivity, by teaching farmers modern methods, giving them a better variety of seeds, and introducing irrigation schemes in the country, we will be able to improve on the agricultural productivity. But we are also of the view that we should attract the private sector into agricultural activity in the country. We are looking at the laws that do inhibit agricultural intervention. The land tenure system is being reviewed. And we are sure that with the review of the laws and increase in agricultural input supplies and the establishment of the effective marketing network will not only be addressing our domestic supplies requirement, but there is a huge potential to even export agricultural produce to other countries, thereby increasing our revenue requirements. Now, over and above agriculture, we are looking at developing the human resource base of the country. The social services have been down. The educational sector, we have done some improvement by increasing the percentage of school-going entrants to 60% from the end of the war. But we still have great difficulties there. The difficulties of inadequacy of teachers. About only 40% of our teachers are trained. A good majority are not trained. We still have over 300,000 children of school-going age without having access to primary education. We have the difficulty of the girl child progressing from primary to secondary school because of cultural beliefs, because of teenage pregnancy and early marriages. These are difficulties we have to cope with. We have to ensure that we sensitize our people enough to change. And what is indeed absent at the moment, we have put in place an educational sector program which has been accepted by ourselves and the international community, but what is lacking is the donor support in terms of fulfilling commitments that were made for the program to proceed. Now, that is so far in the area of education and the health. We are not as successful in the health sector as in the educational sector because, again, of the poor health infrastructure.
I'm going to come back to some of the infrastructure issues in a minute, but I want to get a few other questions in first, and then we'll come back. I don't know if there's another point you want to add to that before I move on to President Preval. We're going to keep asking questions, so okay. But thank you. I think what you did point out was a lot of the balance between some of the short-term things you're trying to accomplish, bringing peace and stability in the country, but some of the longer-term issues that you have, particularly some of the infrastructure challenges. And I think we'll get back to that. But on that, I wanted to just ask President Preval. We had a spirited discussion backstage about this issue of the balance between short-term and long-term objectives. And we all know that Haiti is a country that has been plagued with a lot of short-term issues. And as you've described, a lot of focus and donor interest in helping in emergency situations, but not the ability to do some of the long-term development that needs to happen so those short-term crises don't continue to be repeated. So tell us a little bit about what some of the issues are there for you and how the international community can actually be helpful in that regard. What are the things that you would want the international community to understand better about this balance between short-term and long-term development? And just for the audience, President Preval is going to speak in French, so you may want to put on your earphones.
Merci, madame.
Thank you, madam.
Pendant que je suis ici
while
avec vous,
I'm here with you,
je suis encore obsédé
I am still obsessed by the image of these hundreds of young people, women, elderly people who have been taken away by the waters after the four hurricanes that have struck in less than 2 months our country and other countries in the region. When you are suffering, you understand better the pain of others. You understand better the victims of war wherever these wars occur. You understand better victims of tsunamis, of earthquakes. And in solidarity with those who are suffering, to show that we are close to them, may I ask the assembly, the audience, to stand for a moment and that someone pray for all who suffer on the earth, whether it's through floods, because of wars, because of tsunamis, because of volcanoes. Thank you.
Une prière en anglais.
A prayer in English.
Okay. Well, let's ask God's help and blessing on all the people who are victims of the disasters, either man-made or made by nature in this world. Amen.
Thanks for helping me.
Au nom de tous ceux qui souffrent aujourd'hui,
on behalf of all those who suffer today on our earth, I would like to thank you.
La situation décrite par
the situation described by the president of Sierra Leone is no different from that being experienced by Haitians. And most countries in the third world. I think that, first of all, an effort should be put forth so that within our countries we be able to establish peace, political stability. While Sierra Leone was in war, the concern could not be education or development. While Haiti was experiencing coups, was experiencing political division, it would have been difficult for us to envision the future of education, the future of health care. And that is why my first objective was to invite all our political partners who say the same things as we do. We want to build a country. We want all children to go to school. We want everyone to have access to health care. Let's work together. And that is why we created a government that was widely open in order to have political stability, which is the first condition so that we can take ourselves seriously and for our partners to take us seriously. The president of Sierra Leone, his exposé surprised me, the number of 300,000 children who are not in school. We have 500,000 who have never been to school. He also mentioned agriculture. 70% of the workforce in Sierra Leone works in agriculture. It's the same thing in Haiti, Mr. President. We need to base ourselves on this workforce. The land is there, the water is there. However, we need to organize the markets. We can't just produce, but we must produce to bring profit to the producing populations. So the organization of markets, both within the country and abroad. Not only must we produce, but we also need electricity at a competitive price. We cannot continue to produce or to transform process our agricultural products with energy at the price where it is now. That is why we are going to give priority to renewable energy, such as hydroelectricity, wind power, solar energy, because we can no longer continue to pollute the planet, as was so well said by Vice President Gore during his speech the day before yesterday. We need to do whatever we have to preserve the planet.
Ensuite, il y a
and
les industries pour
there
l'exportation.
Are the export industries.
L'ouverture des marchés.
Opening up markets.
La libéralisation.
Liberalization.
Est une bonne chose.
Is a good thing.
Mais il faut qu'elle soit faite.
But it must be undertaken without hypocrisy.
Il faut qu'elle soit faite.
It must be undertaken
de la part de ceux qui prônent la libéralisation.
Out
pour que
those
les pays
defending liberalization
les moyens
giving subsidies so that all may support competition.
Je reviens à la situation actuelle d'Haïti.
I return to the current situation in Haiti. We have just been through four hurricanes in 2 months, an exceptional situation.
Nous remercions la communauté internationale.
We thank the international community for
le secours immédiat.
Having brought emergency aid,
c'est malheureux de le dire,
it's sad to say,
tant qu'il n'y a pas de mort sur les écrans,
if there are no dead bodies on the screens,
l'opinion publique,
public opinion
se désintéresse
is
très
disinterested
vite.
Very quickly.
Merci d'avoir porté
thank you
le secours
for
immédiat.
Having brought the emergency aid. But the important work remains to be done. It is first to rebuild infrastructures, not to rebuild them such as they were before, because 4 years ago we dealt with the same type of event. If we do not deal with environmental problems immediately, in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, we will again be back looking for emergency aid that will be brought forth. And once the emotion passes, we will return to the cycle of emergency aid. We have asked the European Union an assessment for the mid and long term, but already the United Nations made an appeal, a flash appeal, to the international community because 90% of the crops in Haiti have disappeared in these hurricanes. And in 6 months, we will not have any food to give the population. The United Nations made an appeal for 107 million. This was already almost a month ago, and we've reached only 7% of this amount. And the World Food Program is very worried. So here I'm appealing not only to the international community, but to the private sector to help Haiti see to the needs for the 6 months to come. 90% of agricultural production has been destroyed, and we will be facing enormous difficulties, especially in relation to the increase in the price of products on international markets. There is hope. Political stability has been restored in Haiti. There is hope because when I spoke to President Clinton, when he called me after the floods, he told me,
"We have to build better, build back better."
We have to build back better. It is indeed an opportunity that we had been considering on what needs to be done in the long term. And any tragic situation, if you take the time to study it, can reveal opportunities that are serious. Thank you.
And thank you for thank you for ending on that note of what is possible and the fact that there is, in fact, hope, even though oftentimes some of the situation in Haiti seems so locked in this vicious cycle. So thank you for ending on that note. Let me just turn to you, Prime Minister Blair. You know, one of the luxuries, I guess, after leaving office is the chance where you have to focus on so many different things at all at one time. After leaving office, you have the chance to focus on some of the things that are most important to you and some of the things that really matter. You've been involved in these issues for a long time. We think about Glenn Eagles and the fact that you put Africa on the map, and I think we all applaud you for that and your longstanding commitment to these issues. You focused a lot in this period on issues like governance. And we haven't touched on it specifically, but I think in many ways these issues of governance have a lot to do with how do we take development to the next stage, how do we look at some of the long-term issues that will keep peace and stability. Talk a little bit about your work in governance, what that means, and in practical terms, how do you work with countries around this issue that we know is so fundamental but oftentimes difficult to make tangible?
Well, first of all, I think the reflection that I have, particularly with the work that I'm doing with the president of Sierra Leone now, is a reflection that's born partly of my experience 10 years in office, but also what I've learned afterwards as well. And I think what's interesting is that from what the president of Haiti was saying, it's very much some of the same issues arise. And I really have two reflections, very briefly. The first reflection is this, that if you take Sierra Leone as an example, if you like, of Africa's possibilities and its challenges, the tragedy is Africa is a rich continent with poor people. And the reason for that is very simple, going back over a long period of time. But when we come to addressing it, these are the two reflections that I have, because I think it's important that our policy in relation to aid and development develops as our policy would in any other walk of life or field of discipline. And, you know, sometimes we can carry on thinking about policy in the same old way as it's always been thought. And actually, I think there are some important lessons that we are learning. And the first is this, that one of the key things in order to lift people out of poverty and on the path to development is the governing capacity of the nation itself. And, you know, I found it hard enough to be prime minister for 10 years of a country with a very developed infrastructure of governance. But when I consider the problems and the work that I'm now doing with the president of Sierra Leone, it's important just to understand that a country like that, having gone through this huge amount of difficulty, yes, it's fantastic that they've emerged from this period of conflict, but that, I'm afraid, is only the beginning. Because they've then got commercial systems to develop, legal systems to develop, the infrastructure, not of decision-making, but of decision-implementation to develop also. And these are incredibly difficult things. They're difficult enough when you've got a developed nation with a full range of, you know, civil services and professional bureaucracy. For the president of Sierra Leone, but also for many other African leaders, and I think probably the president Haiti would say the same, you know, we need to help them develop that governing capacity. And that is important both to build the substantial infrastructure of government that is necessary, and it's also important for a second reason, which is this, that they need the right type of private sector investment in their country. Not any type of private sector investment, but the right type. People who are serious, who are committed, who are not going to plunder the resources of the country, but who are actually going to develop the country in the right way. And that brings me to this reflection, therefore, that I think what is important for us is to look upon the modern idea of aid and development as essentially a partnership. Not, if you like, an old sort of donor-recipient relationship where the wealthy world out of its largesse, you know, distributes benefits, if you like, to the developing or the poorer world. Actually, this is about a partnership of equals in which the purpose of what we do is to build the ability of that country to run its own affairs. And I often, I think I've said this to the president and also in the governance work that we're doing, work also with the president of Rwanda, you know, that donor commitment is necessary and that donor commitment is urgent and it's got to be fulfilled. However, we should be in no doubt at all what the objective is of the support. The objective of the support is actually to wave bye-bye to the donor community. Exactly. I mean, that's the purpose of it, so that the country stands on its own feet with its people in charge of its own affairs, setting its own priorities with its own objectives and running a proper and well-functioning country. Because if that happens, and when it happens, then that continent that is rich in resources and potential will have that potential fulfilled. And that is my reflection after the work I did in government and now out of government, is quite simply that, that the purpose of what we do is not to engage in a perpetual act of charity, but actually to engage in a process of partnership that allows Africa to fulfill its own destiny, recognizing that in the end, the solution will not come from without, but will come from within.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's what we all say. We want to put ourselves out of business, ultimately, those of us who are from the international community, by developing that capacity. Let me just turn to you, Dr. Sir, and Secretary General of ASEAN. Everybody else has talked to everyone else on the stage are people who represent single countries. You represent a regional network of countries that have very, very different ranges of economics and different political systems, social systems, et cetera. If you'd talk a little bit about some of the issues you face, and most recently perhaps talk the case of Myanmar, where Myanmar, after the cyclone, had this really difficult clash between the humanitarian need, political issues, and what a regional association network like ASEAN can do to really help the international community in a difficult situation like that.
Thank you very much. I'm also very much appreciative of the Clinton Global Initiative for inviting me here. I asked him in the lobby, is this a one man's Davos? He said, no, it's better. People pay less coming in, he said, but they pay more when they go out. And I think the culture of giving, culture of sharing, is extremely important for the world in our time. President Clinton is going to bring this initiative to East Asia, where we have a tremendous amount of savings. And the culture of sharing is there, but it's not well organized, and it needs to be institutionalized. And that's what we will talk about in Hong Kong early December. But today, I have some reflections of my own, and thank you very much for all the distinguished panelists. I think wherever there is tension, now I'm talking about my own region, you can always identify the problem of the lack of power. It's the poverty of power, of people sharing the governance, of people having the ownership of their own affairs, whether it's in southern Thailand, southern Philippines, northern Sumatra, Aceh, for 30 years, and in many other pockets of my region. 10 countries, 570 million people. Now, we are doing quite well, but I think wherever we have problems, the problems are always based on the fact that people do not have the right to participate, the right to govern, the right to contribute, and the right of ownership of the power structure. So I think first and foremost, we have to identify that what I would call a conspiracy of the negatives. Lack of opportunity, lack of participation, lack of coordination, lack of ownership, lack of preparation, lack of capital. So lack of policies that would be supportive. Now, what the ASEAN countries are trying to do is not by ourselves alone. We have our initiative for ASEAN integration. The diversity that you asked me about, the poorest among us 10 countries is it's about $500 per head per year. The richest among us, I don't want to mention the names, about $55,000 a year. So there is this tremendous gap between us and among us, and I call this a structural defect in the structure. Now, among ourselves, we are trying to help through education, through human resource development, through health, through political dialogue, trying to convince every government that without people's participation in the process, development efforts, development assistance, resources from outside, from dialogue partners, from the EU, will not be able to be digested well, and we will never graduate from this status of receiving aids and assistance from outside all the way into the future. So what we need to do is put our house in order. What ASEAN has been able to do, to achieve in the past 41 years, is a relative peace among us. Between the members and among the members, we have not had open wars for the last four decades, not counting Vietnam, the Vietnam experience, just joined us back in 1997. So But the whole region has been relatively at peace, relatively secure and stable. So we could concentrate on our, first of all, what we call import substitution strategy. We don't have to import as much as before. Exploring our natural resources. Later on, the last phase of our economic development has been described as export-oriented. We produce for the world. And our situation is in between the two emerging giants, China and India. And we want to be the supply line of those two emerging economies. So I think the network that we have built to, in order to attract support, attention, and cooperation from outside has been based on the fact that we could do it at the regional level. There are some problems, some ideas in some corners of ASEAN, 10 countries, that the international community cannot get in to help because of the specific political situation. I'll come to Cyclone Nargis. Cyclone Nargis hit Myanmar on the 2nd and 3rd of May. The country was closed. The country was not comfortable enough to open up its borders, its sky, its airspace for international assistance. ASEAN was asked, ASEAN was appealed to, ASEAN was able to open that humanitarian bridge, humanitarian space, in order to allow international assistance to come in. And right now we are in there. We are trying to maintain that space. We are trying to deepen and widen that space. The international NGOs, including CARE, and the rest are inside, establishing delivery system and bringing in resources. The government is a bit more flexible in coordinating, in helping, in allowing international assistance to come in. We want to be there longer. I don't think there are too many instances of special situation that we are working in order to eradicate poverty than Myanmar. Yeah. 2.4 million people are still teetering between survival and death. And OCHA, the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination, has appealed for something like $482 million for the first year of early recovery. And we are in there to make sure that we help people with livelihood, that we help people with their own basic implements of their livelihood. For example, building boats. If you can give boats to each family, $600 a piece, you can generate the economic activities of the communities of the region. The Irrawaddy Delta used to be a rice bowl of Asia and therefore a rice bowl of the world. There's all the potential to rehabilitate that rice bowl back into its former glory, former status. Now we would like to open up the space, not only to deliver the assistance and the aid, but also to move into some policy discussion, what the UN is trying to do. Policy discussion that would allow some space for the farmers, for the people to produce and to take their own initiatives and to reap the benefits from their own labor and their own work. That is being done, but it cannot be done with some assistance, with some cooperation, with some help from outside. I'm here exploring those possibilities with the UN and with some of you here and with many other philanthropic organizations in order to make sure that we at least save the people first. And then we move into some policy discussion, and then we open up more space, and then we will, as I would call, rather than the conspiracy of the negatives that are imposing upon the people and keeping them from being able to do what they want, to take care of their own life, the way in which Prime Minister Blair has just said, but a convergence of the positives. Give them the power, give them the participation, give them the education, give them the training, give them the good seedlings in order to produce, in order to emerge out of their own poverty, which they have all the intention to do, but the conditions are not allowed. We are working on that. We need help, we need support, we need cooperation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we are running out of time, and I know we have to go to the closing session. I just want to ask one follow-up question, and I look at Cherie Blair. We were having breakfast the other day, talking about some of the work that she's doing to train women in business. And I asked her, what should I ask her husband? And she said, well, if nothing else, make sure he talks about women. So we haven't talked about women at all on this panel. And I think we all know that investing in women and girls is a key to long-term change within communities and development. Some of you talked a little bit about the importance of girls' education and making sure that the needs of the girl child get met. But before we leave, I just throw it open to talk about where are women? Where are women on the radar screen in your priorities, and how do you think that looking at the issues of gender and women are key to development in the situations that you are facing? We can start with you, since your wife said I had to ask you about women.
Yeah, it's always helpful to have Cherie present. I just make one point very quickly, and actually the work that Cherie's foundation will do in this area I think is really important, because essentially what it's about is empowering women to fulfill their potential and understanding there is going to be no future of prosperity for these countries unless human capital is developed fully. And that means developing the human capital that is women as well as the human capital that is men. And so this is of fundamental importance, and not just incidentally to the economy, but to the whole social infrastructure of these countries. So I very much think it, not just because my wife is doing it, but because I think it is absolutely vital. And those countries that are taking this issue seriously are undoubtedly striding forward. So definitely, definitely right. Worth it, and a major part of the future.
Yeah, great, thanks. You know, and I think the case of countries like Rwanda, South Africa, Mozambique, and others who have made it clear that a 30% plus of their legislature needs to be women is another example of how having women in all areas and in all levels in the government is also a key issue. President Karuma, see, you are taking up your microphone.
Yes, we still have a challenging issue out there regarding the empowerment of women. There is still a lot of catching up to do. In the field of education, there has been a substantial improvement in the primary intake. There is no longer the wide gap between male and female in the primary sector. But we still have a difficulty of the transition to secondary school and tertiary education. India, because of, again, the tradition, certain cultural values, the girl child is inhibited. The early pregnancy, early marriage, these are causing a lot of difficulties. And the government is trying to create motivation by providing facilities for the girl child in the secondary school, and we are introducing a system of automatic scholarship at a tertiary education for girls, especially those that are inclined to going for the science subjects.
Just quick, because we need to move and wrap it up. So.
Now, in the political sector, again, we are catching up. We have increased the number of women participating in the local government, parliament, and the numbers are increasing. They are very encouraging. We still have to do a lot more by providing special facilities for them, especially in political parties, for women contesting for positions in political parties and government positions. It is improving, but we still have to do a lot of catching up, and there are advocacy groups that are working on it, and we are overall creating an environment in which we urge the women to come out, be educated, and to participate fully in the governance of the country. It is improving, but there is still a lot of catching up to do.
Great. President Praval, Dr. Surin, if you have just a quick word, because I know they'll cut us off in a minute.
Eh bien, je serai bref.
I will be brief. First to announce the progress in our country. We have a female prime minister who took office about a month ago. Secondly, there is the question of the GDP and the increasing population. The other day, President Clinton said something very true. To control the increase in population, the best thing is to put girls in school to give them education. And I'm going to stop on this proposal, which I think is very relevant. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Searin.
Yes. We have less problem of gender inequality in Southeast Asia. Women are in all professions. In fact, I have just been to a graduation ceremony at a university in southern Thailand. There were more girls graduating than boys. And I asked the professors and the teachers there, what's the problem? What's the reason? And he said, well, boys in this emerging economic prosperity, all of us in Southeast Asia, boys have other attractions. They drop out of schools. They got into many other activities, but girls refuse to be misled. Girls wanted to stay on. Girls wanted to make a better life of themselves, and they are very, very determined. So, in the rice field, in the factories, in the academia, in the media, in politics, they are there. I think we have less of a problem than many other parts of the world. Half of Southeast Asia is, Islam, is Muslim. But the women Muslims in Southeast Asia are much, much more equal and opened and participating in the societies than in many other parts of the Muslim world. So I think on the whole, we are doing quite well on that one millennium goal, that is gender inequality. We are doing very well. Overall, ASEAN is moving ahead in the achieving the millennium development goals. I think we are talking about now MDG plus rather than MDG minus. But I can assure you that the women are in good standing in Southeast Asia. We believe that empower the woman, you empower the world.
Thank you. And that's a wonderful note to end on. And I want to just thank the panelists. This could go on forever, a very stimulating discussion. I think a wide-ranging discussion of the obstacles and the challenges, but also where there are some of the hopes for the future. So I really appreciate all of you and all the time of the audience. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen.